You're listening to Unterwegs, the En Route podcast, where we talk about what it means to be en route with Jesus in our day-to-day life. Navigating life and faith in our complex and changing society is hard. Our goal is to keep you unterwegs with Jesus, moving forward as you follow God's calling on your life. I'm your host, Mike Picanato. Welcome to episode 35 of the podcast. Being joined today again by Stephen and Jenny Jones, who are often guests on the podcast, and by my wife, Alyssa Picanato, for part two of a conversation that we started last week on March 21st about the war in Ukraine and about what we're seeing here in Berlin, which is really not terribly far away from the Ukraine border. As of this past weekend, there were news reports saying that there are now more than 120,000 refugees from Ukraine living inside of Berlin. And so there are some impacts, things that we're seeing in our daily life. And we talk about that a little bit in the podcast today. I'll make some closing comments at the end to let you know a little bit more. For now, we're going to rejoin the conversation that we were in the middle of it for part one of this series. And if you haven't listened to that, you may want to go back and pick up the topic of conversation there first. How is it impacting your daily life? I mean, none of us are hosting refugees in our home, but it doesn't mean it's not having an impact in what's happening every day, both from an emotional or a spiritual or maybe a physical way. What are some of the impacts you guys are feeling or experiencing?
I think one thing that comes to mind is just how much us as a family is aware of what's going on. So, you know, even my 9-year-old son is interacting at home and at school and is, you know, you never know like how much they're like internalizing or feeling necessarily, but even the fact that he's aware of it and recognizing that it's not like a distant location, and his classmates are also talking about it. So, and then that, you know, then trickles on also up into the upper grades and then how we're interacting with it at home, and then trying to, you know, it's a constant thing that we're praying about. It's not stopping. It's not something that all of a sudden we can be like, thank you, Jesus, it's all over. It's like, it's not, it's continually something on our minds and yeah, trying to figure out how to process that.
Yeah, the day-to-day, but it reminds me of like the closest thing I can think of is like when somebody dies that's close to you and you look around, you're like, how can you all be just walking to work or to school or driving here and there? And don't you realize that my life just completely radically changed? And it's so strange to be like, I'm the person who's still walking here and there and, you know, getting around and doing all these regular things while there's so many people that are in our neighborhood because they're getting shelter there, or people that are still in Ukraine that every single day are under threat of bombs and things. And it's like, it's just that constant juxtaposition of the ordinary everyday and death. And so how do you continue doing some of those normal everyday things when you realize that it's so close?
It's maybe a weird response, and I don't want to be too much of a mood changer, but the German people tend to be very stoic. And I've found myself on multiple occasions in the last 2 weeks walking by a conversation where I just assumed these were kind of normal stoic Germans, but I'm hearing what I assume is Russian or Ukrainian being spoken instead of German. In the park yesterday, Alyssa, as you and I were walking, multiple conversations that we heard of people just out enjoying a sunny day. Who were speaking a language that I do not know.
It was definitely something I noticed too, on just the amount of hearing this Slavic sounding language. And I've heard it before over the years. I'm familiar with the sounds. We have a friend who's Polish and speaks it with her kids all the time. But definitely hearing these languages a lot more means it's because people, that's their first language, it's their mother tongue, and so they're using it actively here just like normal because they're here now.
I think one of the things that has been a challenge for me is I had ways that I would interact with news And of course, there's been plenty of bad news in the last, you know, decade where we were living in Minnesota, listening to the radio as I'd go to and from work, those 15-minute, you know, segments. I was able to kind of get a sense of what was going on. And sometimes, I mean, you know, gosh, ISIS and then everything happening in Syria and other things around the world that were just so hard and heavy. But I got them in kind of little, you know, nuggets. And I don't have that, partly, you know, I don't drive here. I haven't yet figured out what my new news sources should be or, you know, what they will be. And so I find myself not able to control my intake of news very well. And so I'll spend hours just in it. And it's not good for me, but I don't know how not to do it. And some of that is because I'm new here, you know, and some of that is also because I think it feels like I know I don't want to look away. I mean, so healthy boundaries and that kind of thing are always a struggle in the first year of transition anyway, right? And then you throw something you experience something so constant and intense and disruptive to so many people. Yeah, so that's been an interesting thing. I think it definitely has been taking a toll on me, the awareness of what's happening. And then, yeah, not really knowing what to do. I mean, we had a guest staying with us this last week, and I'm asking myself, I didn't actually ask it out loud because I didn't figure it was the right time to do that. But, you know, asking myself, could we host a refugee here, you know, but then still feeling like we're still trying to figure out how do we live here, you know, like, yeah, what does that even look like? And
we also do a morning liturgical prayer time 3 days a week, and we spend time just kind of in free prayer for other people, and our prayer time together has absolutely been impacted by what's been happening in Ukraine over the last 25 days. And I remember early on, Stephen, you saying, I find myself praying the imprecatory psalms.
Yeah, that was new.
I echo that. But there is a time where you're like, wait, it's okay. There's permission in the Bible to say, have this person fall into their own trap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that I've always been very uncomfortable with the imprecatory psalms, you know, with the, yeah, and some of them are so, I don't know, so yuck.
The imprecatory psalms for those listening are the psalms that are almost violent prayers.
I mean, sometimes are outright mm-hmm. violent prayers. Yeah.
Where David is pleading with God, or the psalmist is pleading with God to do something to his enemies, that they're pleas for justice that really have much more physical, tangible feelings to them, plow furrows into their back or crush their bones or turn their teeth into powder, kind of prayers that, yeah, you're right, they're uncomfortable to even think about praying. And sometimes reading them, you feel...
Yeah, I feel weird. Gross.
Or
yeah.
Confused, yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think before, I've always dealt with really hard things, or not always, but I've come to deal with really hard things like that by pressing into lament. And then I think in some ways the most imprecatory prayer that I've prayed before was, you know, Lord, let them see what they're really doing. Let them understand, because the weight of that would be so crushing. But yeah, this, I find myself interacting differently and even finding comfort in the imprecatory psalms that I, you know, that, okay, it's okay to feel this way, or at least there's some example of feeling this way in scripture. And then, you know, I'll have to keep processing that for years. But yeah, that's been a very new, yeah, an uncomfortable reality.
I think it's interesting because David, who wrote many of these psalms, was very much a warrior. And so I'm sure this language wasn't far from his thoughts and thinking. I'm not that much of a warrior, much more pacifist in my leanings than King David was. And there's times where I come across these psalms and I say, well, I'm uncomfortable with how that would get worked out, but God, something needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's where the prayer part comes into me, where I can cry out to God. And I think even as David is processing this transition from warrior to king to wanting to see the temple come to Jerusalem, I'm wondering how much there was even in him saying, what does it mean if I put the responsibility for this onto you, God, instead of strength? He certainly also prays, strengthen my arms for battle. But then when he's praying, but God, you need to do these things. Yeah.
The other piece of it is just the overwhelming sorrow at the loss of life all around. So I think on the one hand, resonating with the imprecatory psalms, and then on the other hand, you know, not wanting the request to be necessary, I guess.
How much does the nearness of this enter into your thoughts on a regular basis?
Multiple times a day. I can't count it.
I mean, the strikes over the weekend were 10 hours away with a new type of missile, these hypersonic missiles that are undetectable by radar. And so you read these things and I just think, oh man, we are so close.
I think that's what is surprising, like, because I don't think I'm reminded every day because I'm new-ish. It's like, you know, we generally know the map, right? But then it's like to actually live in a place and look at the map and point out where you live and where these things are happening, it continually surprises me. Yeah, even as we talk about, you know, different parts of Germany or different parts of Western Europe, or different things. You're like, oh, that's like, we would drive that on a regular basis. Like, that's not out of the scope of how we travel. Like, it's, we would drive 10 hours from our home in Minnesota to my parents. So like, that was
like several times a year.
Yeah, that was a day. So it's like, oh, that's surprising.
Yeah, my internal geography still thinks I'm in the U.S. And so when I hear about Asia or these different places, I'm like, well, that's so far away, without realizing that halfway, you know, that Ukraine isn't far away, that Moscow isn't. I mean, Moscow's still far away, but it's as far away.
Kyiv was on my short list and of places I want to go to that I've been thinking for the last few years. I'm like, okay, I've got to get there so I can go visit these friends there. And I'm like, why haven't I done it yet? And I've thought that multiple times over the last few years, like, okay, there's got to be a time coming up soon. And I even have a magnet on our refrigerator because I collect magnets from everywhere we go. And it's because it was sent by this one friend. And so, like, I've got to check that one off. And now it's like, oh my goodness. It's that close that it was on my very, very short list of places I want to visit. And now I still want to go there, but it's going to be so different than if I had made it any time before last month.
I think it also, like, so reading U.S. media and people talking about, well, why doesn't NATO do this? Or why doesn't Poland do this? Or why doesn't Germany do this? And I think, gosh, it really feels different when it's like, I mean, so you can say, well, they would never dare to attack, blah, 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 you know, but many people would have said that about the scale of the attack in Ukraine as well. Mm. And so I think, no, it's very much it's a real question of, yeah, I mean, we're just a short missile flight away. And yeah, that does cross my mind on a regular basis. Particularly, did you see, I mean, and I don't even, it's so hard to know what to believe, but did you see the images of the Russian helicopter that said "To Berlin" on it?
I didn't.
And it got shot down. So that saw a before and after picture. And then, you know, that's like, I feel good that that piece of equipment isn't coming here. I don't want to feel good about the loss of life with it, you know, but gosh, you know, I would say for sure Cold War history is making way more sense to me now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really the way I would have wanted to learn it.
So our middle child is 19 years old. Caleb, he was on one of the earlier episodes of the podcast, and he had a friend over shortly after everything was starting. And I just remember this young 18, 19-year-old German, other nationality child sitting at our table thinking, what do I do if there's a mandatory draft again? What do I do if there's a war? And these are thoughts that young people in Europe have not had to think about since the end of World War II. What happens if I have to now fight? And these thoughts, watching these young people wrestle with those, to me is probably one of the more heartbreaking things in the middle of so much upheaval in their lives at the end of a pandemic, a couple of years of university not working out the way most people would want them to work out, people not knowing what to do with their lives now, having in Europe anyway this potential threat of armed conflict where they get called up is super, I mean, disruptive seems like the wrong word, but scary.
I think the other thing here, so one of the things that I really appreciate about being in Berlin is that there's so much effort given to remembering well. And I think that's really good and really important. I'd say in my first couple of months here, just being surrounded by all these memorial markers and other things, I had, I don't know how many nights that I didn't sleep well because the reality of what has happened here was becoming real to me in a new way, like what happened to my historic neighbors, right? People who lived on the same street that I live on. And I would wake up, not in a panic, but just in this, just this really, I don't know, gripping reality of like people who lived on my street were taken away and murdered at concentration camps. Like that happened. And I think as people are looking from Berlin to the east and seeing this thing happening not very far away, there's a very real awareness of how bad things can get. And I think that that, on the one hand, probably helps to inform policy decisions, but it also, I think, I don't know, introduces a sense of reality that is, on the one hand, very good, and on the other hand, terrifying.
Talked already about the refugees that came in 2015. And one of the things that we are seeing as we have partners in other alliance ministries that work very heavily with this Arabic-speaking population in Berlin is some pretty strong reactions as they're watching interactions with the incoming refugees. And some of those reactions are probably normal. All of them are normal. I don't know that I would say there's abnormal reactions coming through, but I would say some of them are reactions of incredible disappointment at what could have been as they're watching a population of people coming in that look a lot like Germans. I was saying I couldn't tell the difference as I was walking down the street just looking at people. That's not necessarily the same reaction that some of the Syrian refugees got. Alyssa, we have a friend, Yosef, who's interacted a little bit with that online. What have you seen or heard from some of the other contacts as they've been interacting with this?
Very close to the beginning. So maybe on 25th, 26th of February, somewhere around there. Some journalists made some very rude comments about this civilized country, which really felt like a slam on everybody that was a refugee from a country that the skin tones are not the same shade as many people in Germany or Europe, but also the same as many people in Germany and Europe. But mm-hmm. So, and those things got shared on and reshared. And that was very distressing, not at all fair, and that was said. So that's something that came out, I guess, speaking more from my own personal observations, is that there was a lot of openness, a I remember there were people that were making welcome signs for refugees from Syria and in the area, so that they were welcomed with, you know, teddy bears and greetings and open arms. There was not as much opening of individual homes, but I think a lot of that traces back to the tide coming in versus the tsunami. And the government was much more involved in helping to check people in so that they wouldn't be lost and so that they'd find places to stay, their beds set up in gymnasiums and things, which is what's happening again. That gave me some sad flashbacks, but also encouraging that there is space for people, even if it's in situations that only happens when there's a crisis. So there's been a whole bunch of help. The same lists that were started and systems that were started are being restarted. So there are some similarities, some differences, but I see a lot more in common between these two reactions than I see differences.
So many similarities in how German people are reacting as well. Similar problems also. Some of the problems being, I mean, governmental institutions are by design sometimes a little slower to react, and most of the time that's okay. But when there's crises, of course, that's a little more challenging. But also some really good commonalities, like when you go to volunteer, there are places that are saying we have enough volunteers, mm-hmm. or when you go to donate things, people that are saying, we don't need any more of that right now. And this is the same from my perspective as it was in 2015.
Those are the same conversations, the same things I've read online. Yeah, it's really amazing how many things are being repeated.
I think it'll be interesting to see 3 years from now, 5 years from now, what the differences are. And if people from Ukraine are welcomed more into German culture quicker, then that'll be increasingly painful or marginalizing for some of the Arabic-speaking immigrants. But I don't know if we know enough to know now.
One of the questions that I have that I'm curious to hear from you two about is, there's been a range of U.S. responses, like both at the, it seems like at the political level, it's been kind of more of a unified response, although it's starting to fragment. And then, but then at the social level, there's kind of some very different responses. I'm curious how that is in your awareness and how that affects you.
I think for me, there have been a variety of circumstances in the last, really since the Syrian refugee influx, that have step by step chiseled away any desire to be on Facebook or social media. And so I have very limited interaction on different social media platforms, which sometimes isolates me from responses and social responses coming from the US in ways that for me are very healthy, and other ways that disconnect me maybe from some of the public discourse. Where I do get news, where I do see different people's interactions, I find myself just vacillating between being incredibly encouraged and incredibly discouraged. And I think the encouraging is when I see people interacting with the people that Alyssa and I know that are also on social media, and see them responding with how much they're praying for them and how much they're encouraged. The discouraging side for me is probably more reflective of where I am, for good or for bad, in my own feelings to the use of war or use of violence, and just the lack of real engagement from some of my friends, some people I know, with ways of coming to a solution that don't include war. And I don't know what those answers are, but it often seems like either somebody's an idiot for not sending armed response, or they're a warmonger for an armed response. And I don't know, for me personally, where to go with that. But I do find myself sometimes wrestling with the increasing polarization that I see, where these are the only two solutions, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of creativity in the middle. I don't know what the middle looks like. I don't know how you have a half war response and a half peace response. I don't know what that response is. But I think sometimes that's disappointing. More disappointing are the extreme kooks who side with Putin, or who I see siding with Russia, and I just can't, from where I'm sitting here, I just cannot understand the logic behind that at all.
I have a lot more questions than I have answers on how do people process things? What are they thinking about what's going on right now? Something I learned through the Syrian refugees and through the reporting and stuff is that it's just too big to grasp as a complete story. It works better to learn from one family or from like what's one person's story. I think that's a lesson that I've embraced, is let's hear the story of individuals. And so part of me following what's happening right now and some other people in my circles we're all connected with the same family in Ukraine. And so there's this very personal aspect of getting her updates. She's been doing almost every single day. And so that's a way that I'm getting the same information in some ways as people in the US because of the shared connection. Yeah, I don't know how, I think we need to hear those stories in order for us to have a better idea of then how to take it from the micro to the macro. That's the only way that I can do it sometimes. It's just too overwhelming.
Reducing the big down to the individual stories of people, you mean?
Sometimes I need to start with individuals to get to better understand the big stuff. Mm-hmm. For me, I keep thinking, okay, but what does this mean practically? That word is very, very real to me, is that I use a lot of headspace on the what's going on, but I keep coming back to, but the thing is what can I do practically?
Mm-hmm. So we've been wrestling with that here internally as well, in part just because of timing, with you guys in language school, and with us getting ready to go on home assignment, and with a variety of pieces that are moving and in motion. How do we respond to refugees coming and to crises as they occur?
It's hard to feel like a good answer to that question is, go spend more hours in language school. even though that I think in many ways is the best answer for us at the moment, it really feels disconnected from the plight of people around us.
It does make you able to help people as they come in if you're able to communicate in German. Mm-hmm. And if as you learn the systems that are in place here, so that is a ministry. And then something that helped me understand somewhere as Syrians were coming in and right now too, was that the complete upheaval, even though we moved here in a time of peace and it was a decision we made together, it was still our life completely. There's so many things that changed moving from Minnesota in the US to Berlin in Germany. And it's like that feeling of overwhelmness when you're like, oh, I need everything for my household. Oh my goodness. And some of those feelings is like, okay, that means I'm better equipped to understand what people are going through right now and where they might appreciate help or the offer of help.
This idea that we have at Envision Berlin of how can we be a ministry hub? How can we how can we be present in ministries that are happening around us has caused us to have a few, so far fairly small, but willing to be a place where people could drop things off. Not a lot of people took advantage of that, but still the willingness was there, the sorting. And I have another project coming up this weekend where we'll be sorting and working again with Serve the City in Berlin to help with some of the project. And connecting teams that are coming into those things. But a lot of that is just stopgap stuff. And so part of that is, well, I don't want to invest too much of our time creating something that's only in the short term and other people are doing that really well. How can we help them in what they're doing? But the long-term thoughts, the longer the war goes, and even looking at some of the pictures, it's we will have Ukrainians living in Berlin for years.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I find myself dwelling often is what do we need to do that's going to make an impact, or how can we make an impact that's lasting a year from now or 2 years from now or 5 years from now. Well, guys, there's often at the end of our conversations where there's some sense of, well, this has been really good and
this has been really bad.
and I don't want necessarily to leave people with a, wow, how this is a miserable situation, but I also want to leave people with that this is a miserable situation.
It's very, very serious. There is war happening. And there's been wars in other places. This one is one that is, it just feels so much more direct.
And it feels like we're constantly walking the razor's edge. And you see this in news and what government leaders are doing and their mistake. We're constantly walking the razor's edge that this could escalate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, on the one hand, frightening. And in every hand, very sobering.
And then there's this other reality, right, which you mentioned earlier, Alyssa, that like the person who doesn't know that you've just lost somebody, right? Like it's a beautiful day out and we had a really nice pastry earlier. And there's like, you know, there's like this reality that life is continuing on in really normal ways too, which is its own really complicated thing. Yeah. I mean, it is good enough here that we feel good inviting other people to be here with us, you know? And then at the same time, there's this great uncertainty.
And I think even in that, like the beauty of the desire for solidarity, the desire for peace, like in amongst all of it, there is that hasn't been squashed yet. It's more like there's a sense that there's a threat, and in some places it is, you know, under attack, but yet there's still a very overwhelming desire and a call and a shout and a, I don't know, exclamation, fill in the blank, for peace.
Well, guys, thanks. Thanks for listening to the podcast today. As I said at the beginning, there's a few comments I want to make at the end of the podcast today. And one of those is that Alyssa and I had the opportunity to be in a Arabic speaking church this Sunday where I was able to speak, and in conversations with some of the people there, just want to acknowledge that the feelings of many of the Arabic speaking refugees that came to Berlin are way more complex than we can understand from our outside perspective. And while we were here, now, for both of these influxes of refugees, we can't really completely understand how people from a different culture are feeling or processing some of the things they're seeing. It's important to remember that they're experiencing a refugee people from a war-torn country coming into a different country that's not their own, which for them feels very similar. And they recognize that they were not welcomed into homes as much as the Ukrainian refugees are being welcomed into homes. And other complications include how quickly Ukrainian refugees are able to find jobs compared with how quickly they were able to find jobs, or the fact that many of them don't need to show papers to get employment, proving education, the same way that the Syrian refugees had to show papers to get employment when they came. Just to say that the situation is complex, and I want to make sure that because we talked about it in the episode today, that I'm also acknowledging that we don't always understand the full complexity from our position. The other thing I want to say is that there are ways that you can help. You can go to Comma Services, which is a ministry of the Christian and Missionary Alliance, and you can give money to helping with the Ukrainian refugee situation And that money will go to help refugees in a wide variety of situations, including those who are first fleeing from Ukraine and arriving in Poland, and those who are arriving in different sites in Germany, including arriving in where our colleagues in Varen are working, where they're bringing refugee families into the city of Varen and then finding accommodation for them and helping them get set up. I will put that link in the show notes for you, so feel free to click on that. And Common Services is a great organization, and I can't recommend them enough. And then just finally, in closing, we want these episodes that we record also to be part of sparking dialogue and starting a conversation. And if you have questions or comments, please feel free to email us at podcast@envisionberlin.com or to go to our Discord server where you can join the conversation there. Thanks again for listening. Unterwegs, the En Route podcast, is a production of Envision Berlin e.V. and is produced, recorded, and edited at Sprig, Envision Berlin's creative space. Podcast music is by Mike Piccinotti.